Welcome to another segment of the Grassy Knoll. We're recording this on February 13th, 2005. With us today is Paul Collins. He's an author, and he's also contributing to a series that is including his brother Philip in a series titled Magicians of Mutability. This is Visigoth. Harry's not with us today, and we want to tell you that, not that you should get confused, but these two Collins brothers have done some kind of work on what is going on today and its roots back centuries ago. And Paul, you are the author of The Hidden Face of Terrorism.
That's correct.
And the co-author with Philip in The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an Examination of the Epistemic Autocracy from the 19th to the 21st Century. Do you guys have a third work coming up at all, or are you planning another book?
Well, we're planning on doing this. We're taking the second book, the Ascendancy, and we're going to write an expanded, revised version that's already in the works. And basically, we're going to move a few things around in the original, and we're going to expand upon several of the ideas that we expounded in the first edition. There was just so much more that could have been said about the issue that it's something that we needed to do, and so that's what we're working on right now.
All right, before we get into the topic for today, which is the Venetian oligarchy, can you give us a thumbnail of what one could find in your book, The Hidden Face of Terrorism?
Sure. Well, The Hidden Face of Terrorism basically takes to task the orthodox academia model of what terrorism is. It takes the assertions put forward by the mainstream universities and mainstream university instructors, the contention that terrorism is just the act of lone nuts with no funding from governments or no government sponsorship whatsoever. It takes that apart. It takes that idea apart and basically puts forward the contention that terrorism is not so much the act of lone nut groups, just small groups of disenfranchised misfits and radicals who are venting their frustration through acts of terrorism. Instead, terrorism is a well-coordinated social engineering project carried out with sponsorship and shepherding and funding from national governments, and those national governments in turn are being controlled by a group that exists above government, the elite, the power elite, and this social engineering project is geared towards breaking down the human psyche, the breaking down the personality and building a new personality, one that favors security over freedom and is willing to actually trade freedom for security, which is not really security at all but an illusion of security. And we saw this with 9/11. People were absolutely scared to death. They were shocked and traumatized into basically pliable lumps of clay that the elite could sculpt in any form that they liked and wished to, and the people backed the president and backed the idea of a homeland security apparatus, which bears ominous parallels to the security apparatus of several socialist regimes, national socialism in particular, Germany, and also the security apparatus in the Soviet Union. And in both of those cases, the security apparatus was more geared towards war on the people, war on the population, war on dissent, than it was on terrorism, and then more than it was geared towards procuring a security for the people. And the book is by no means a comprehensive look at the whole phenomenon of state-sponsored terrorism, but it lays out the case studies well enough to where people should get a sense of what terrorism really is all about.
Terrorism is not a new trick, is it, though?
No, As a matter of fact, it goes back nearly 6,000 years in history to Cush, who was the father of Nimrod. Cush means confounder, and that's exactly what he did. He'd confound people by sending these rogues and rabble-rousers into various city-states and thugs and whatnot, and they would begin to generate terror. And then he would show up on the scene offering the solution to that problem, offering to bring peace and to bring back stability on the condition that the people would hand the city over to him and make him the ruler. And they inevitably did, and the all the chaos would, you know, magically disappear. And really what was going on was that these thugs that that were in his employ would cease to carry out the chaos on order of Cush, and the city was thus handed over to him. And so this method has been recycled down through the years over and over again, and it's just I've marveled at the fact that very few people have caught on to this method, and that's one of the reasons for writing the book was maybe not to so much give a comprehensive study into state-sponsored terrorism and look at all of the cases, which would have took thousands of hours of research and study, but to take a few select cases and to introduce people to the method.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's a good thing that you get out as much work as you can, because no one ever really knows when that all might be brought to a swift end. So if you can get out less quicker, it's probably a good thing for the people, because they need as much information as they can. And I guess what I'm saying is, to try to do, say, a Carol Quigley-sized work, who knows how many years that would take, and it just might not ever get out there. So, I think it's good that you get out what you can and when you can. One of the other things, Paul, is that, you know, it seems every generation has to deal with a terror element. And we did a show on a speech that was given up in Harvard by a New York Republican, in which he warns about the trend in the United States society and this willingness, it seemed, to sacrifice freedom for security. But what was interesting about the speech is that it was given in April of 1955. So here was a gentleman, his name was James Lord O'Brien, who was telling people in that year, watch out what's taking place. And of course, the boogeyman back then, Paul, was communism.
Well, the communism was from the beginning propped up and funded by people in the West, Western mm-hmm. factions of the elite, to create an enemy that would cause the people to rally around the Western faction of the elite. And the Western faction, ironically, would offer as the solution their own unique socialist model. They offered up basically a united socialist world that would act as a bulwark to the communist imperium. And I believe with Vladimir Putin in power now, and I believe with the sweeping changes that are happening under his guard, that we might see that kind of situation arising again. I think that we might see another Cold War situation, and of course that'll frighten the living daylights out of people, and people will once more rally around the Western mm-hmm. faction of the elite, and they will once more offer up their own kind of police state conditions as the solution to that growing menace over there. And as a matter of fact, in the ascendancy of the scientific dictatorship, we take a look in the very tail end of the book at what is coming down the road, and we take the body of evidence concerning Russia and take the body of evidence concerning China and show that they are being built up and that they are getting brave again, and that the cosmetic changes, and that's really all they were, cosmetic changes in Russia, are dropping away, and it's beginning to become a model for opposition again.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see that whole Hegelian dialectic that was carried out during the Cold War starting all over again. The one problem, however, that I point out in the book, and that Philip and I both point out, I should say, is that this time the elite in the West might not be able to manage it as well as they did during the Cold War, and it might actually spill out into overt war between nation states.
And one last question as we turn ourselves from what you had written about in The Hidden Face of Terrorism. It's not a good idea sometimes to try to time events, but I'm going to ask you, just out of my curiosity, what stage or phase or period are we in with regard to a cataclysmic event? I mean, are we decades away, do you think, or, you know, what's your take on that?
I would actually, I don't want to sound like an alarmist, but I see something happening this year. What it could be, I could only hypothesize. There's too many factors in the long term to say, well, it will be this or it will be that, that it will be war with this country, or that it will be a massive terrorist event coming from this sector. But I see something happening because plans have been accelerated, because the elite they understand that their system is not based on reality. It doesn't commune with reality, and they're trying to outrace its collapse, and so they have to accelerate the plan in the hopes of preventing the whole system from falling apart. So I believe that we can certainly look for and see things in terms of terrorism and in terms of other chaotic kind of events as early as this year.
The topic for this show, I guess we could call it a study of the Venetian oligarchy. And just as a point of interest, I interviewed Joan Vian a couple of days ago, and she had just put out a newsletter that talked about the fact that, these are my words, but the British Empire, or the death of the British Empire, has been rather premature, and she explained what had happened. And she had also said about Soviet Union, when both these nations supposedly decolonized or streamlined or whatever, they still, by, I guess you could say, fear of reprisal, still control the votes of those decolonized nations. So whereas England only had one vote in the UN, now they have 54. Whereas the Soviet Union only had one vote, now they have 13. So on paper, it looks like they decolonized, if you will, but actually they probably gained more strength in this world forum of the UN. But looking back at Britain now, because I think we feel very much the same way, that that's a center of what is going on with this global takeover. What is the Venetian oligarchy, and what is its ties to Great Britain?
Well, we see the beginning of the Venetian oligarchy with Ham and his descendants. They basically began the post-flood rebellion against God, and Ham had basically done something to offend his father Noah. Many people have theorized that it was quite possibly homosexual rape. Rabbinical tradition holds that this was the case, and that Ham's son Canaan was involved. And Canaan, as a result of whatever they had done, was cursed by Noah. And the Canaanites carried a kind of spirit of defiance. I'm kind of verging over into the realm of spirituality now, but I kind of find it as an unavoidable dimension to all this.
So do we, right?
But they have a spirit of defiance, and they basically turned away from traditional worship, the worship of the Lord, and chose to worship Baal. And Baal was simply another name for Cush, and who was the father of Nimrod. And worship of Baal involved child sacrifice and ritual prostitution, and the Lord considered this an abomination. And we see God in Joshua chapter 3 verse 10 saying that he would drive the Canaanites out of the land before the Hebrews as a result of everything that they were doing because of the depravity and the infanticide. And the Canaanites, however, they did not cease to exist. There was a fairly large population of Canaanites that stayed in the tribal lands, and the Israelites chose not to push them out, and as a result, they intermingled with these Canaanites, and that preserved a lot of their occult practices. And remnants of the Canaanites changed their identity after, I believe, 12 BC. They became known as the 1200 BC. They became known as the Phoenicians. And in AD 466, the Canaanite Phoenicians established a city known as Venice. And Venice was a major center of commerce for the Mediterranean region. And the Canaanites now called themselves Phoenicians, and they continued with the occult traditions of Ham, Canaan, Cush, and Nimrod. And Venice would provide the Babylonian mystery religion with a conduit to the modern world. They would use their wealth to accumulate that they had accumulated from their monopoly over commerce to conduct a covert war against the Christian world, against the traditional way of life. And Rosicrucianism was part of that project. And it is in Rosicrucianism that one finds the origins of Freemasonry. And Freemasonry would, from the top of British society, from the top of English society, right on down, take over and gain dominance. We have to follow an outline to get there. Rosicrucianism began with a Venetian friar and Kabbalist who was named Francesco Zorzi, which is spelled Z-O-R-Z-I. And his family was one of the top ruling families of Venice. And he was also the author of a work that contained a lot of Hebrew Kabbalistic ideas. And he had another work, which was a manual for magic, and claimed that the angels would guard those who practiced that magic. And in 1529, he traveled to England to act as an advisor, or misadvisor is probably a more appropriate term, to Henry VIII. And in that position, the friar provided Henry with a theological loophole to justify divorcing his wife, Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of the King of Spain. And with Catherine successfully removed, Henry could marry Anne Boleyn, whose family was also had a Venetian background. Then the reason for that manipulation on Zorzi's part was to prevent an alliance between Spain and England that might bring about a second League of Cambrai. See, in 1509, the League of Cambrai, which had been called together by the papacy, had declared war on Venice, and it came very close to destroying Venice. But the papacy ended up breaking the league up and making a peace with Venice, and but Zorzi or Zorzi rather, however you pronounce it, remained in the court of Henry VIII until his death in 1540, and it is there that the friar is said to have began a school of initiation into different mysteries and different known as Rosicrucianism.
Can I ask you a question there too,
yeah.
Paul? All right, so this situation with Henry VIII and the divorce of Catherine, one, is this the situation that cost Thomas More his head?
I believe that somehow is involved. There's a trajectory there. And all it's basically the beginning of a split in Christendom and some of Thomas More's ideas being rejected. Philip is really a expert on Thomas,
okay.
on Thomas More and on the role that he played in all of this.
Well, did the papacy object to the divorce, or did they at least nominally object, but really it was okay with them?
It's my opinion that they objected entirely.
Okay.
This is why, you know, Henry VIII basically, you know, told them where to get off, basically. It should be noted that the papacy is by no means lily white, and that they have their faults, and they had played a role in the sorry state of world affairs. The thing is that there's also evidence to suggest that the Priory of Sion was involved with the formation of the Rosicrucians, mm-hmm. and so we see a tie over into the work of Bainchet, Lee, and Link in their book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, mm-hmm. Because an adept known as Ormus, who supposedly laid the foundation for the Priory of Sion, had his sect... sect that he started as his sect symbol was a cross surmounted by a rose, and the Templars, the Templar Knights, eventually took the emblem of the Red Cross, while the Rosicrucians claimed the rose as their symbol. And it should also be noted that in the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the authors point out that the Priory of Sion was supposed to have a second subtitle. They were supposed to have one subtitle known as Ormus, the name of this adept. And outside of that, they were supposed to have as another subtitile the Order de la Cross Veritas. They were basically probably the power behind the Rosicrucians, but through the Rosicrucians, the Venetian oligarchs were able to hatch a plan to divide Christendom. And like I said, the Catholic Church was teeming with corruption and theological and doctrinal error, but it still, to an extent, served as an umbrella for the majority of those adhering to the Christian faith. And if the proper and necessary reformations were to be initiated, then Christian civilization could have been steered back onto the straight and narrow path. But to the Venetian ruling class, that was unthinkable. So the Rosicrucian order moved to control the Reformation movement, and they did so through Martin Luther. Now, Martin Luther, I don't want to vilify the man. I believe that that much of his work was needed, and it was very important what he did. And I believe that he, as a Christian, I believe that he received a degree of revelation from God. But it should be noted that Luther's personal seal presents us with evidence of Rosicrucian influence and control. It consisted of his initials, and then it had the rose on it and the cross, and those are chief symbols of the Rosicrucian order. And Luther's ideas sometimes contained Gnostic concepts that paralleled the Rosicrucian beliefs. As a matter of fact, one of his associates, Philip Melanchthon, said that Luther, he saw Luther's work as quote-unquote Manichaean delirium. Manichaeism is Gnosticism. But Luther wrote against some of Augustine's ideas. He wrote that Luther's ideas that Manichaeism was bad was actually an error. Augustine was involved in Gnosticism for a time, and he eventually broke with it and had written several critiques of it. And Luther found actually the ideas of Manichaeism to be favorable and desirable over Augustine's ideas, and objected to Augustine's criticisms. But it would be instructive to probably look at Manichaeism for the tenets and the beliefs a little bit. They were started by an individual known as Manny, and Manny saw himself as above Jesus. He said that Jesus was merely his forerunner. But what the Manichaeans said was that the earth and all material things are of negative value, that this is in fact a prison. And because the physical realm experiences what they consider to be decay and entropy, it's evil. That's not true biblically. As we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 verses 16 through 17, the body is considered a temple of God, where the Spirit of God is supposed to dwell. But they saw our bodies as transient shells, and they believed the God of the Bible to be evil because he was the creator of the material universe, and their attitude was that he was trapping pure spirit in a physical shell, and therefore he was actually an evil, vindictive, cruel God, in that the serpent in the garden was the actual hero of the Genesis account, because he was liberating man from this and from the chains and that the traditional God that we recognize had placed them in. And we unfortunately see some Gnostic beliefs creeping into Protestantism as a result of this influence on the life of Luther. And what eventually happened was that the Rosicrucians used the Protestant Reformation as a way to politically weaken their enemy, their traditional enemy, the Catholic Church. And this worked in a lot of ways. Christianity was cut right down the middle, and two different camps had formed as a result, the Protestants and the Catholics. But eventually, even the Protestants would begin to push out this influence. They'd begin to push this Gnostic influence out, and it's not as prevalent today as it was back then. But the damage was already done. If you look around in the modern world today, there are countless, numerous denominations. We don't see anything that we could come close to describing as unity between Christian brothers and sisters in the Christian world.
Paul, if I could ask you a question.
Sure.
This Harry would have asked you if he were here, because we had this discussion, and I kind of thought, I didn't really go along with it, but honestly, I've got to ask it for Harry. He showed me one day something very interesting, and I had been brought up Lutheran, and he showed me the symbol that I had always seen in the church on the Christian flags, the pastor. And that was the symbol of Lutheranism. Is it not a cross and a rose?
That's correct. Yes. You're actually reiterating what I just said.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
So, but the thing is now, where that's only symbolism, now you're saying it is fact that Rosicrucianism had an impact on Luther.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I don't see him as having some kind of sinister motives, and I don't see him as being some character of high villainy. I think that he was a well-meaning, genuine Christian. It's interesting that when Philip Melanchthon had fell deathly ill at one point in his life, that Luther came and prayed for Melanchthon, and Melanchthon was miraculously made well, and the man was virtually on his deathbed at the time. So I do believe that the Lord worked through him to a degree. But it should be said that when you look at the undercurrents of history, when you look into to what makes up the conspiratorial dimension of history, you have two groups. You have those who are very much aware of what they are doing, and then you have unwitting dupes who are very good-hearted and who believe themselves to actually be working for the right, and have no idea that their sponsors or the influences on their thinking might have a different agenda. And that's what I think you see with Luther, and also so that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
But if we could clarify one thing, if you can speak to this, and that is, Luther did not necessarily come up with that symbol, did he? Or, I mean, did that come after him? Is that the work of something or someone else?
That's probably the work of somebody else. It should be noted that he had, in the book, The Gods of Eden, William Bromley points out that he had been involved with a group known as the Friends of God, which had several occult ideas and several Rosicrucian ideas as their tenets, and it is possible that's where the symbols and the ideas behind those symbols originated. I believe that the Friends of God were started by an individual named Mershwin, and I believe that he had come in contact with Luther. Now, this doesn't mean that Luther, though, consciously comprehended anything that was being fed to him. It should be noted that historically, secret societies and esoteric groups have always had a cover story. They've had one version of their doctrine that was meant for the masses, for those who they considered to be vulgar, and then they had an inner doctrine for the true initiates and for those who were at the heart and soul and core of the group and knew what the group's true objectives were.
You just described, really, the whole strategy and the infrastructure, if you will, of most secret societies. And I'm thinking about Freemasonry in particular, with Pike's remarks about how we would keep lower degrees definitely in the dark about what the great plan was.
Yeah, that's correct. In Morals and Dogma, he stated that the Blue Lodges were to be but a portico, you know, but just a window on real Masonry. And that's why it's so important when going into the topic of Masonry, to handle you know, individual members with care, because so many of them are really basically real salt of the earth kind of individuals. I have to say that I've known a lot of rank and file Freemasons that live in the area and in the places that I frequent, that are very nice people, very good, and see themselves as engaged in something fraternal, and see it as merely an opportunity to give something back to the public, a chance to help people. It would be wrong to say that the Shriners Hospital hasn't done its fair share of good work. And the reason for this is that these people are by and large completely ignorant to what it is that they're involved in. So ignorant to, in fact, that they can see no qualms with going to the lodge on Wednesday night or whenever they meet, and then doing their dutiful service in whatever church of their choice on Sunday.
As a last look at this bit about symbolism, and we were just talking about the Lutheran symbolism, which has definitely a resemblance to the Rose Cross. It wouldn't be the first time that questionable or even occult symbolism has seeped into the church, and it reminds me also of Morals and Dogma. And Pike had a page in which there were some graphics crudely placed in there, like by freehand almost, that looked. And he said, he almost laughed at Christians when they embraced, for instance, and I think you remember all this also in Protestantism and also in Catholicism, that P, letter P looking figure with an extended shaft, more or less, with the X that goes across it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that dates back to the Resh, I guess, from Egyptian sun god worship, like a staff of sorts. He also showed the Star of David. And that is clearly Masonic, whether you want to call it interlocking pyramids or compasses, but that the church really has embraced quite a bit. In fact, I just got an article, which I think I passed along to Philip. I don't know if you saw it. And it was basically saying Happy Ishtar instead of Happy Easter, showing how that particular Christian, I wouldn't say holiday, but event, was hijacked by occult forces. And that goes back to Nimrod as well.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, it happens around the time of the vernal equinox.
Right.
We know that the rabbit, which is a prevalent symbol, is a sign of fertility, right, which goes back to the fertility worships and aspects of the Nimrod mysteries. You know, the idea that the sun, which represents Nimrod, impregnates Semiramis, which is represented by the earth and sprouts life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, then the egg, which is another symbol of Easter, is a very, very important symbol to occult groups. Christians have basically taken these as their own, and
right,
really haven't given much thought beyond the surface explanation for what these symbols mean.
Well, a last remark. I started thinking about this as I read it, and I said, "Yeah, you know, I circulated it, and most people bore witness with it." And I would even have to go as far as saying that, lo, those many sunrise surfaces, services I attended probably also had a little bit of an occult tinge in the fact of the sun rising, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, oh well.
It's a sad state of affairs. At the same time, I think that most people are genuine in their sentiments. Not that I believe that God will by any means overlook ignorance, but I believe that because they're genuine, that eventually there's going to be some kind of awakening, and at least a portion of the Christian world is going to come out of a lot of this nonsense. And
go ahead.
Go on.
All right, at this point, let's do some business because we haven't given you an opportunity to talk about where people can purchase the book. We want to remind people that we are talking with Paul Collins. He is the author of The Hidden Face of Terrorism. And with his brother Philip, he has co-authored The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an examination of the epistemic autocracy from the 19th to the 21st century. Now, number one, how can people purchase that book? Where are the venues where that happens?
Okay, they can basically get it at the Barnes & Noble website, barnesandnoble.com. They can get it also at amazon.com. The second book can be published at iuniverse.com, and that's all one word, I believe all lowercase.
Right, right.
And then the other book, The Hidden Face of Terrorism, can be purchased at Author House, all one word, all lowercase, .com. And I know that if they buy it through Barnes & Noble and through Amazon.com, that those two have rather quick and speedy shipping, and it should be to them in no time.
Also, are there any websites where either excerpts of the books appear or articles by yourself and Philip too?
Yes, actually, there is. Philip has some of his writings that appear in the book at I believe biped.info.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And I have some articles at Paranoia. One article at ParanoiaMagazine.com over the psychology of Abu Ghraib, and let me think here. News with Views also carried newswithviews.com also carried an article that Philip wrote entitled "The Alchemy of Eugenics," and here shortly, I'm not too sure any day now, though newswithviews.com will also be carrying another article that the two of us put together called Neoconservatism, the cult of techno-socialism, and I believe that article is already up at your website,
right,
as well. And basically, if you just do a Google search of the on the web, you can find where of either one of our names, you can find where many of these articles are and where they've what websites they've been spread around to.
You're listening to The Grassy Knoll. This is Visigoth with Paul Collins, and let me just do a real quick thumbnail to bring us back to where we broke off the conversation. When we talk about the Venetian oligarchy, we're looking at a continuum that goes back to Cush of the Old Testament through Nimrod, the Canaanites, the Phoenicians, who then set up a city-state, and that is Venice. Is that correct so far?
That is correct, yes.
Now, when we see this seep into England, is this more of a philosophical or a spiritual invasion more than a military one?
There is a political dimension to the takeover in Britain. However, there is also a dimension where it's more of a philosophical, as you said, the spreading of an ideational contagion. In the 1600s, there was an aggressive effort on the part of the occult movement, on the part of the Rosicrucians and the remnants of the Templars, to establish dominance. In the 1640s, the Rosicrucians and the Templars began to infiltrate Mason guilds in the British Isles. And slowly but surely, the guilds were shifted away from building and architecture toward the occult beliefs that were established in the mystery schools. According to Albert Pike, the Templar and Rosicrucian infiltrants concealed themselves under the name of Brother Mason, and we see the formation of Freemasonry on the British Isles being part of a much larger plan to depose the Storts and take over England, because the Storts had become, to an extent, a threat to the Merovingian dynasties of Europe, and they had to be removed. And with the help from Rosicrucian supporters, Oliver Cromwell, who was a Rosicrucian Mason, headed up the English Revolution, and success came for the Rosicrucians and the Templars around 1649, when Cromwell had King Charles Stuart beheaded. And then, with the 1688 Glorious Revolution, Freemasonry entered every walk of British life, and that even includes the church in Britain. And we saw the complete takeover of the Mason guilds in, I believe, 1717, with the first Mother Lodge, where operative Masonry almost became non-existent, and there was a complete shift to speculative Masonry. And since that time, Britain has been used as an outpost, as a base of operations for this movement.
You had stated before that you can't help but see this in a spiritual sense, and I agree wholeheartedly. And it's interesting, I just had a house guest, a listener from out in Texas, who's an atheist. And just this morning, as I bid him goodbye, I told him, you know, I'm not trying to proselytize you, but you have to remember this, and that is, even if you don't believe in God and Satan, though he says he understands good and evil, I said, you got to understand that they, meaning the Illuminati, or however you want to refer to it, believes in something very spiritual and very dangerous. So if you don't, fine, but understand they do. How do you feel about that?
Well, I agree with you entirely. And the problem with being an atheist is you're the perfect candidate. You're right up their alley. You're heading down the correct path, because atheism is not so much the disbelief in deity. That's what some people where some people get thrown off, and they're very much put off when I say that in different conversations and in different social circles, when I have said atheism is not a disbelief in deity. They look at me and think, well, gee, what have you been smoking? But atheism is more correctly a belief in emergent deity. It is a belief that there was no God in the beginning. However, mm-hmm. There can be a God in the end, and that God can be humanity if humanity follows the path to apotheosis and to perfection. Mm-hmm. And I realize that not all atheists are aware of this philosophical problem with their beliefs, but those who do become acquainted with this aspect of atheism begin to head down the Luciferian path.
Right. Now, when I first encountered the Venetian oligarchy, I kind of had a hard time believing they were any kind of entity at all. They really don't appear too much as a big player in your regular textbooks of world history. However, because this is an extension, really, of Satanism and leads to what will be the satanic takeover, which is one world government, Venice was very much empowered, and because of the spiritual attachment, could pull off what they did.
That's correct. If you look at, as a matter of fact, if you look at any of these groups or these pestilential ideas, these ideational contagions, you have to scratch your head and wonder what's behind their longevity. I mean, they're like the philosophical equivalent of a Jack LaLanne, you know, the fitness phenomena, who is now 90 years old and still chugging forward, doesn't look a day over 65. And the only way that you can reason that there is such longevity is that there is something that transcends the physical world that we see, the world of the senses, safeguarding and shepherding these ideas and these different groups.
Well, I mean, and really, and some even some evangelicals look at me with scorn and say, well, how can you have this generational, if not millennia-long plan? And I'm saying, now, listen, you told me you believe in Satan. You know he was cast to earth. What do you think he's been doing in the last thousands of years, you know? I mean, he's been to work to try to pull off another revolt. And I said, so if you know that you've got this, the second most powerful, I guess you could say, entity in the universe at the controls, can't you understand how you could have this kind of plot go on as it has?
Exactly. But most Christians, I believe, I know that with one church that I was involved in for a short period of time, there were people that were in fact involved in the Masonic Lodge that were members of that church. And I spoke to the pastor of the church about the research that in the body of literature, and he didn't want to say anything that would set off or offend these members of the congregation that were initiates into Freemasonry. So there's a fear of being offensive, but to tell you the truth, we've reached a terminal point in history where it's more important that we survive and that we make it through victorious than it is that we avoid offending anyone. The avoidance of being offensive is actually killing us in some respects. And all we've reached a point now, and I'll definitely go into this. How this point of history we're in now, where we have to be receptive to the truth and have to be sharing that truth and disseminating that truth, no matter who it hurts and who it helps.
We only have about 7 minutes left, and what I want to do is ask you if there was a goal that you wanted to reach regarding the Venetian oligarchy. I'm thinking perhaps, you know, what is the current state of affairs with this influence? And if we do have some time after you can answer that, then I'd like to patch a couple of things up with quick questions. So I'd ask you, what is the present state of affairs with this influence?
Yes, the most important aspect of this coming out of the Venetian ideational contagion is depopulation. Most people don't realize this, but Thomas Malthus, who started the whole Malthusian trend and this idea of depopulation, was influenced heavily by a Venetian known as Giammaria Ortes. And Karl Marx was one of the individuals that caught him on this. Karl Marx despised Malthus and said that Malthus had merely plagiarized Giammaria Ortes. And Giammaria Ortes held that the Earth has a carrying capacity, and that its capacity to carry a population, a sizable population, was finite, and And this prompted many different people, including Malthus, to hold that you have to do away with a sizable portion of the mouths to feed. And we now see, as a result of this this idea of depopulation that began with Geomeria, or Ortez's idea of carrying capacity, we now see a problem of population implosion. And I'd like to turn the audience's attention to the Christian Science Monitor issue of October 7th, 2004. It's very important that they get a copy of that and read the article by David R. Francis in it, which goes into this population implosion. You see, we've now had, since Roe v. Wade, which was in 1973, I believe, 36.5 million abortions here in the United States. And instead of seeing a population increase, we've actually seen a population decrease to the point where there is barely a future generation to generate the monies needed to keep the Social Security fund going, and it's looking like boomers are not going to be able to retire on time. As a matter of fact, Greenspan, Alan Greenspan, has come forward and actually discouraged boomer retirement. And even if we were to get busy now, populating and procreating to try, these children would have to be brought up to maturity and they're not going to be brought up to maturity to beat out the Social Security insolvency. This might have played out in some measure to the boomers' advantage. It's a known fact that continued activity and exercise later in life contributes to longevity and might actually help people live longer and healthier. But the problem is that many of the boomer generation has already fallen into ill health by middle age for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is eating food that is totally devoid of any nutrient value whatsoever. You hear, just yesterday we heard that McDonald's is being sued for trans fat that's in their cooking oil, and how that clogs the arteries, and people have literally made breakfast, lunch, and dinner these fast food restaurants. And then the boomers have also they never kicked their drug habit that they had from the days of the counterculture and the hippie movement. They merely replaced their illegal drugs of marijuana, LSD, acid, whatnot, with drugs that are legal and deemed all right by the FDA, drugs such as Prilosec and Vioxx and Zoloft
and Prozac
Oh yeah, you just go right on down the line, and they became hooked on these drugs, and now it's being found that these drugs actually do more harm than they do any good to the human body, and they're very taxing on the human body. I'm personally a believer that the human body is supposed to last for a long, long time, hundreds of years.
Well, Paul, we're going to have to hold you right there because we're coming up on about 30 seconds left in the show. We want to thank you for being on with us, Paul Collins. We will speak again. We're doing a multi-part series with you and Brother Philip. Paul has written The Hidden Face of Terrorism and has co-authored a title, we'll give you the short one, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship. Paul, we want to thank you so much for spending time with us, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Viz. I look forward to it.
All right. God bless and good night.
Good night.
Okay, there we go. Yes, pray with me for a moment and we will get started here. Heavenly Father, we want to say thank you. We thank you, Father, so much for this day, because this is the day that the Lord, the Most High, our benefactor, has made. We will rejoice and are glad in it. We are grateful and glad for the manifestation and our presence and our consciousness being here at such a time as this. So right now, Father, as we are here and experiencing this life with others that are yours and are called by your name, we ask that your Spirit that leads and guides us into all truth would quicken us, lead us and guide us, Father, not just to a knowing, but to the actions that we take that are also part of the manifestation and part of us working in collaboration with you, the true architect and the one that is above it all and is bringing your purposes to fruition upon the earth at such a time as this, as you gather those that are yours. Even as you, Jesus, spoke and said that you didn't come for the world, but you had brought your ones out of it. We just thank you that you have brought us out of it, Father. And so we ask that you would just continue to quicken us, continue to guide us, continue to lead us, Father, in your plan and your purpose. And as we would spend some time in your word, we would ask that you would speak to us in it and through it, in Jesus' name. Okay, thank you. Okay, if you've got your scriptures, actually, I just want to do a quick side note just in line with that prayer. Before we start on the main ones we were going to get into, I just want to jump forward to John 17. And where Jesus had said in verse 20, he said, "Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe, not on me through their word, that they may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me." You know, it's very, very interesting, because sometimes, you know, people can get so wrapped up in what's going on in the world that we fail to get that we are not of the world. You know, we're experiencing this world, yes, but we're not of the world. You know, you can get wrapped up in the museum, you can get wrapped up in the playground, you can get wrapped up in the movie that you're watching. You know, you may be watching a really good movie, but when the movie is done, you carry on because you're not the movie. You know, you are watching a movie. You can go and get lost in a movie. People do that in a very good production. Nowadays, it's pretty hard to find a good movie. You know, there's a handful of people that I know that produce amazing stuff these days. Some of them that are very close to us, like our buddy Zeph. But yeah, there's not that much good production out there. But in good productions, you can get lost in the content. But in this world where Jesus said you'd have trouble, take heart, but I've overcome the world. That's in verse 33 of chapter 16. In the world, he said, you'd have trouble, but be of good cheer because I have overcome the world, right? So we sometimes can forget that that this is not who we are. This is something we're experiencing as a witness, as an observer, as somebody that is coming through this place. But this is not who you are. And to recognize the right way and the appropriate way to go through this experience is part of becoming and being an overcomer. And so this is part of the call. This is part of what all of those that are the Most Highs that belong to him are called into, of recognizing who you are and then moving in that during your experience here. Okay, I want to start with some of the earlier scriptures that we wanted to start with. Let's go to John chapter 10. And start at verse 7. And then said Jesus unto them again, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them." Now, how many? All? All. "All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal, and to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly." Okay. I want to read this again, because I want this to sink in. "Then Jesus said unto them again, Verily, verily, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal, and to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly." Okay. Now, Jesus, being the way, the truth, and the life, being the manifestation in this reality of the way and the truth and the life, speaking truth, lets those that have ears to hear, hearts to understand, minds to understand, hearts to receive it, know that, one, he's a door. So, okay, there's a way, right? So you've got to go through that. Well, there's a way to go, right? There's truth in its pure form. And life that comes and flows from him and from being connected to the source of all things. And all that ever came before him were thieves and robbers. You know what? Those thieves and robbers haven't gone away. They're still around. My gosh, are they still around. And they disguise themselves as angels of light. They disguise themselves as ministers, as those that speak the truth. But they do not. You know, when things have not been resolved within you, when there are those secret things, those hidden things, those footholds of the enemy in a person's soul, when the time comes, that now becomes the access point. And you will see your Judases in those times. You'll see Judas. Judas pops up in the scriptural story of Judas. You've got, I mean, the scriptures talked about him being a thief and helping himself to whatever went into the money bag, right? And that being a place where the devil had a foothold inside of him. And then when the time came, it says that the scriptures talk about Judas that was actually entered by the devil to go and betray Jesus. So there are those that do this with full intention to steal, kill, and to destroy, and to rob. But they also, there are those that, because they have not gone forward in truth, and they have not done that inner work, and they have not been real with the Most High, and they've not they've not gone through that process. They leave these places, these hidden areas, these hidden rooms. And the enemy knows about it, because in the spirit, all things are known. God knows about it. Listen, nothing is hidden. Nothing is ever hidden in the realm of the spirit. All things are known there. You can hide things from people in the natural, but even that is getting more and more difficult because of the time that we're coming into. The time that we have come into, I should say. You know, so often people talk about, oh, these things are going to happen. This is no, actually, certain things have happened. You know, a split has taken place. You can see it now as the parting of the ways gets stronger and stronger, as there is more of a divide between those that are aligned with the frequency of truth and the will of the Most High, and those that are part of the construct, part of the world, part of the world system, part of the furniture, part of the play that will be played out in the backdrop while you walk out God's plan and purpose for you and manifest what He has for you during your time here. They will be part of the furniture behind the scenes at all levels. At all levels. From the kings all the way down to the man walking barefoot on the street, up and down. You can see all kinds of things happening and taking place. But doesn't matter a person's station in life. What matters is who they are aligned to. Who are they one with? Are they one with the truth? Or are they aligned with the world and the world system? Are they aligned with the illusion? Are they aligned with the Maya? Are they aligned with that which is at enmity with God? Are they part of that Babylonian system that was spoken of in the book of Revelation, in which was all of the blood and the prophets, blood of the prophets, and of all the people that have of the Most High? You know, when there's a speaking of Babylon, one of the pieces that's discussed was that in Babylon was found all the blood of the prophets. So that's the system that has set itself up. It is, as you go forward in this time, more and more you're going to see the split. Now, Jesus speaks of coming that we might have life and that we might have it more abundantly, right? Okay. So now, let's look at some other things that he said, shall we? In a time where the world is trying to get your attention and the world is trying to get you to do certain things and align yourself with certain ideas and certain ideologies. Well, let's see what Jesus spoke about that might pertain to our life and the backdrop of what we're seeing and what is going on around us right now. Let's go to the book of John, chapter 8. And verse 31 says, "Then said Jesus to the Jews which believed on him, if ye continue in my word, then ye are my disciples indeed. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Okay, well, if you're continuing in his word, you're doing his word. You're actioning it. And if you're actioning it, you're going to see the manifestation of it. If you're seeing the manifestation of it, you are going to be living that life. So you're going to be a disciple. A disciple is a disciplined person. All right. Verse 32, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." They answered him, "We be Abraham's seed, and were never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, ye shall be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin, and the servant abideth not in the house forever, but the Son abideth ever. If the Son therefore shall make you free, ye shall be free indeed. I know that ye are Abraham's seed, but ye seek to kill me, because my word hath no place in you. I speak that which I have seen with my father, and ye do that which ye have seen with your father. They answered and said unto him, Abraham is our father. Jesus saith unto him, If ye were Abraham's children, ye would do the work of Abraham. But now ye seek to kill me, a man that hath told you the truth, which I have heard of God, this did not Abraham. Ye do the deeds of your father. Then said they to him, We be not born of fornication, we have one father, even God. Jesus said unto them, If God were your father, ye would love me. For I proceeded forth and came from God. Neither came I of myself, but he sent me. Why do ye not understand my speech? Even because ye cannot hear my word. Ye are of your father, the devil, and the lust of your father will ye do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speak a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar, and the father of it. And because I tell you the truth, ye believe me not. Which of you convinceth me of sin? And if I say the truth, why do ye not believe me? He that is of God heareth God's words. Ye therefore hear them not, because ye are not of God. They then answer the Jews and saith unto him, Say we not well that thou art a Samaritan and hath a devil? Jesus answered, I have not a devil, but I honor my Father, and ye do dishonor me. And I seek not mine own glory. There is one that seeketh and judgeth. Verily, verily, I say unto you, if a man keep my saying, he shall never see death. Then said the Jews unto him, Now we know thou art a devil. Abraham is dead, and the prophets, and thou sayest, If a man keep my sayings, he shall never taste of death. Art thou greater than our father Abraham, which is dead, and the prophets are dead? Whom makest thou thyself? Jesus answered, If I honor myself, my honor is nothing. It is my Father that honoreth me, of whom ye say that he is your God. Yet ye have not known him, but I know him. And if I should say, I know him not, I shall be a liar like unto you. But I know him and keep his sayings. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. Then said the Jews unto him, Thou art not yet 50 years old, and hast thou seen Abraham? Jesus said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. Then took they up stones to cast at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. Ah, wow. Okay, so Jesus came that we might have life and have it more abundantly. And yet when he spoke the truth, you see how those that heard his words, if they were not aligned with the truth, if they were not one of his, the reaction, the visceral reaction that they had to that truth that was spoken unto them. Verse 38 said, Jesus said, I speak that which I have seen with my Father, and ye do that which ye have seen with your father. And they answered and said unto him, Abraham is our father. Jesus saith unto them, If you were Abraham's children, ye would do the works of Abraham. But now ye seek to kill me, a man that hath told you the truth, which I have heard of God. This did not Abraham. Ye do the deeds of your father. Okay, so in John 10, Jesus talked about all that came before him were thieves and robbers. Now you get into real world real-time interactions between those that are the thieves and the robbers and Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life, speaking to each other back and forth. And in this situation, this is old school character assassination. This would be the modern day equivalent of them taking your Wikipedia page and locking it and rewriting it. This would be the modern day equivalent of them breaking your links to your talks and your audios, or removing your channels, or scrubbing everything that you've ever done from the internet so nobody else can ever see it or hear it, which if you've been around us, you know that that's happened numerous times. Why? And Jesus, what Jesus' words, he says, look, I'm telling you the truth. And look, even with Jesus, what is he asking for? He's not taking or extracting anything. He's sharing the truth. He's freely he's received, freely he's giving. And look at the reaction. And the reason is because there is no place for his words inside of them. Verse 37, he says, I know that ye are Abraham's seed, but ye seek to kill me because my word hath no place in you. Because my word hath no place in you. Because my word hath no place in you. You know, part of what Jesus has done, and he's even done it in this day and age, is he offers the word, he offers the truth, he makes it known, he brings it forward. And what you end up seeing time and time again is that his word has no place within many. And these are people that would many times too feign themselves as spiritual, as religious, as God's people, right? One way, shape, or form. Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing how there's so many out there that have that form of godliness but deny the power thereof. And what did Jesus say? You're going to know a tree by its fruit. So here we are. Here we are in this set, in this interaction, in this situation. And the back and forth that goes on in this situation, where the attempt to discredit him, the attempt to silence him, the attempt to... look at verse 48. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, say we not well that thou art a Samaritan and hast a devil? You know, so, first of all, let's attack anything that we can, right? Because what happens when they don't like the message? Well, they attack the messenger. There's got to be something wrong, something to deter, so that nobody else wakes up. Because he's come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. And so when that life and that abundant life is now being made known, they've got to deter people. Look away. Well, why? Because they're thieves and robbers. And the thief and the robber doesn't want to be found out. Because if you turn the lights on and you see the thief or the robber in your living room, you're going to deal with that thief or robber, right? If you see where they're stealing from you, you might close the window. You might close the door. You might put up a fence. You might prosecute them. You may turn them over. There's a lot of things that happen when the thief and the robber is found out. And so when the thief and the robber, when their scam is being made known, they want to dissuade people from listening and hearing. When people start to recognize that the scam is being made known, they want to shut that down. When people, well, here's one scam, the maritime jurisdiction coming onto the land. Check it out in Revelation 13. The beast that comes out from the sea and onto the land. This is under law merchant. This is where your scams are in modern day society. Scam, scam, fraud, fraud, again and again, extraction and stealing of value under law merchant. Offer, consideration, three tithes, and now presumptive jurisdiction and implied consent. I'm not going to get into all this at this time. You've got enough right there just to go start studying this out. That is part of the scam. Now you know. Study. Study to show yourself approved. Study. Study the word. Study the truth. You know the truth is out there. You know, don't get hung up. The truth will win out. If you've got a heart for truth, when something is not aligned, it's going to be exposed, and you'll be able to pivot as you need to. You keep going forward in truth. You don't have to get everything perfect. You just have to set your frequency for that which is real, and God will reveal to you in the path. Okay, so let's go into a few more things. Let's talk about some things that are relevant to modern day, from some of the pieces that Jesus also put forward. Okay, let's go to Luke chapter 10, right? We got global conflicts going on. All right, let's go to Luke chapter 10 and verse 25. So Jesus came that we might have life, have it more abundantly, right? Okay, so let's see what he's talking about in this terms, in other teachings in relationship to that, because it all ties in. Verse 25, chapter 10 of Luke, verse 25 says, "And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tempted him, saying, Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He said unto him, What is written in the law? How readest thou? And he answering said, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy strength and with all thy mind and with all thy, and thy neighbor as thyself. And he said unto him, Thou hast answered right. This do, and thou shalt live." All right. Well, this is, you know, let's stop. Let's just put a pause there for a second. So Jesus came that they might have life and have it more abundantly, right? So, and this guy asks him, "What shall I do to inherit eternal life?" Ongoing, everlasting, continuous life that you can experience even now. And Jesus asked him, well, what do you think you should do? He said, "What should I do?" He said, "What do you think you should do? How do you read it? What do you read in the law? How, what do you think?" You know, so often, sometimes, you know, we got to ask that question. People say, "Hey, well, how do I get along? What do you think you need to do to get along? How do I make my life better? What do you think you should do to make your life better? How do I have good friends? Or what do you think you should do to have good friends? You know, how do I have good business partners? Or what do you think you should do to have good business partners?" You can just ask you know, so often we know the answer to the questions that we just asked, but we don't want to answer them. We want to ask somebody else, because then when we get the answer from somebody else and we don't like what we hear, we want to then go bludgeon the person we just asked. You know, how often do people go online and they look at videos and they watch these things and then they go and spam the comments? You know, if you don't like it, just leave. Carry on. Stop listening to people that are putting out dumb things. You know, that's where the bots live, in the comment sections of those things. You're hanging out there with a bunch of robots. Most of the time, that engagement isn't genuine anyways. Why are you wasting your time? You know the answers most of the time within yourself to the questions that you asked. Is this a good person for my life? Why do you got to ask the question in the first place? If you got to ask the question for the first place, then you probably, there's something already going off in you saying, yeah, maybe this person should be kept a little bit further away from you. All right. Verse 27, and he answering said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy strength and with all thy mind, and thy neighbor as thyself. And he said unto him, thou hast answered right. Do this and thou shalt live. Verse 29, but he, willing to justify himself, said unto Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Then Jesus answering said, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among, there's those thieves again, fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead. And by chance, not on purpose, not on purpose. Oh, no, no way these guys would on purpose do this. But, and by chance, there came down a certain priest that way. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And likewise, a Levite. Levite. And likewise, a Levite, when he was at that place, came and looked on him and passed by on the other side. All right, so they see, they know, they get it, and they go on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion on him, and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn, and took care of him. And on the morrow, when he departed, he took out 2 pence, and gave them to the host, and said unto him, take care of him, and whatsoever thou spendest more, when I come again, I will repay thee. Which now of these three thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And he said, he that showed mercy on him. Then said Jesus unto him, go and do likewise. Go and do likewise. Go and do likewise. So I have come that thou might have life, and have it more abundantly, right? Now, an expansion of what to do to inherit life eternal has been given with instructions to go and do likewise. So now, if you got people on the other side of the world bombing the hell out of each other, which side do you want to be on? Have you picked your side? Have you gotten wrapped up in the furniture of this world? Have you picked the Maya? Have you chosen that and followed the thieves and the robbers who Jesus said, all that came before me were thieves and robbers. He told you who they are. Are you going with them once again to your own destruction and your own peril? Or will you go and do likewise? Like we said, you already know the answer to the question. Here we are. Jesus didn't come for the furniture. He didn't come for the Maya. He didn't come for those that rejected the truth and have been given over to strong delusion. So believing the lie, they may be damned. He didn't come for them. He came for you. The many are called, but the chosen are few. What's your response? Will you go and do likewise? Listen, you act out of what you believe. You respond according to what is truly resonant within you. The split has already happened from what I've seen. This is time to walk it out. This is time to go forward in manifestation. This is time to be who you were always destined to be, who you truly are. Scriptures talk about how we are seated in heavenly places. That's your truest form and your truest expression of who you are, is beyond this place. And who you are in here needs to align with who you are beyond. And if you're still trying to win here, you're not ready to leave here. To him who overcomes, not to him who wins. There's a difference. To him who overcomes, not, doesn't say to him who wins. See, winning in the eyes of the world is not, that's not what our objective is here. Jesus in his life, according to the world, was not a winner according to the world in their standard at all. But that is the overcomer. That is our example. Listen, does that mean that you may or may not win in the eyes of the world? It's irrelevant. It's immaterial. You can win or you could be second, third, being also ran. Doesn't matter. Do you get it? To him that overcomes, to you within yourself, how the world sees you doesn't matter because they are irrelevant. It is about you recognizing who you are and moving into that, into your place, your sovereignty, your power, in oneness with the Most High. You got to recognize who you are and be at peace. And as you're at peace, as you allow for this, all of this, Jesus said, my peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. I don't give you peace like the world gives you, right? So internal serenity amidst external turmoil. When I studied that out, that's the conclusion of if you were to put that into English. But I believe that's just so much more than that as well. His peace that he leaves with you. His peace that he gives to you. Not as the world gives. It's within you. Flows through you. And when we step into that and walk in that, this entire thing changes. Your experience in it changes. And what you manifest outside will change. And those around you, you will set the tone. You will set the world. See, the world keeps trying to get you to participate with them in the creation and the co-creation of their reality. But you have it within you because you've been made in the image and the likeness of the Most High. And you have the creative spark within you to create universes, worlds, manifestations of all kinds. You don't have to give that to them. You don't have to consent to them at all. Remove your consent from that explicitly. Walk in the truth. And once you do, and once you begin to move in your power, and the more that you do it, the stronger you get. The more that you do it, the more that you comprehend who you truly are. You know, the word understanding means to stand under. That's why so often with these fraudulent jurisdictions, they'll ask, do you understand me? Do you stand under me? Is what they're saying. They could use the word, do you comprehend, if it's about you grasping what they're saying, but that's not what they're saying. They're asking you, do you stand under their jurisdiction? But in relationship to what the Most High is doing with you, you want to understand what he's doing. Because you want to be under the jurisdiction, juris being law, diction being language. You want to be under the jurisdiction of the Most High. Walking in that spiritual frequency, in that spiritual connection, aligned with the way and the truth and the life, and go and do likewise from that place. Not for a show for others that you plaster everywhere. Because this, the story of the Good Samaritan, he didn't do it for a show. He did it because that's who he was. And many times, there will be few that see what you truly do. Because you don't do it for them. You don't do it to be seen and applauded in the marketplace. You do it because it's who God has you to be. And it's the truest expression of who you are in this life and in this experience. You help because it's what God quickens you to do. You're generous because it's what he tells you to do, what he puts within you to do. You have these ideas and this inspiration, and you bring those things to pass because it's what he's put within you to do. You go and do likewise because it's who you are. Not a show. You would do it whether anybody knew or did not know. It doesn't matter. It's not about winning here. It's about overcoming. And in that, your life, victory, and God's plan and purpose is manifest. This is the most incredible, incredible time. If time was real, this construct is the most incredible window to be here. This is it. This is it. So enjoy it. Enjoy it, my brothers. Enjoy it, my sisters. Take heart. He's overcome the world. We overcome in him, through him, and we walk this out. In Jesus' name.